This episode of Ann Arbor Stories contains graphic accounts of murder, mayhem, and worse. It's intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised. This is Ann Arbor Stories. I'm Rich Redding. On a hot August night in 1931, a pair of teenage lovebirds sat in a parked car down on Lover's Lane in Ypsilanti, doing what teenage lovebirds do when they've lied to their parents about where they're headed for the night. 17-year-olds Thomas Wheatley and Harry Lohr were the evening escorts for two young girls visiting from Cleveland, 15-year-old Vivian Gold, who was Harry's cousin, and 16-year-old Anna Mae Harrison. They canoodled in Wheatley's dad's two-door, six-cylinder Willys sedan, windows down, warm summer breeze blowing off the Huron River. Two in the front and two in the back, kissing sometime around midnight, parked down at Peninsular Grove. It's now called Peninsular Park, not far from the old Peninsular Paper Company. It was then that two men stepped out of the darkness, guns drawn, and asked them all to raise their hands. In the pre-dawn hours around 5:15 a.m., police received a phone call from a farmer in Ypsilanti reporting a car on fire near his property on Washtenaw-Wayne County Road, now Rossinville Road, southeast of Ipsy. Police and firemen rushed to the scene and saw a two-door sedan ablaze, flames shooting out of the interior. First responders pierced the gas tank to prevent an explosion, but it was nearly empty. They extinguished the flames as the sun broke the horizon, revealing the grisly scene inside the car. Badly charred bodies piled in the front and back seat of the torched interior, the windows nearly melted, but the engine in the front of the car in relatively good condition. Police roped off the crime scene and tried to make sense of the brutality. Four nearly unidentifiable bodies removed from the interior, which was obviously and intentionally set on fire. Signs pointing to a murder scene in a nearby ditch. Police found unmistakable signs of a struggle, bushes and reeds beaten down and obvious traces of blood. A blood-stained high heel shoe lay in the grass nearby. They traced the license plate to Thomas Wheatley's father, who was brought to the morgue to identify the bodies. He recognized two keys his son always carried, as well as a belt buckle worn by his son's friend, Harry. Wheatley's son had left the house that night, telling his parents he was attending a young Masons meeting in town with his friend, Harry. At Harry Lohr's home, his cousin Vivian, visiting from out of town with her friend Anna, told the grown-ups that they were headed to the movies. The teens slipped away together and were last seen around 8 p.m. Monday night. It was in those early hours on Tuesday morning that their bodies were found. Police began one of the biggest statewide manhunts in history, even going so far as to allow the head of security at the Ford Motor Company, Ann Arbor native and resident Harry Bennett, to put his own men on the case. Bennett's crew of questionable employees included former murderers, kidnappers, and henchmen of every stripe. And law enforcement officials were so desperate to find the killers, and quickly, that they gave Bennett unparalleled access to the case, allowing him to investigate the crime scene, learn all the facts, and eventually become a key player in the interrogation room. The first break in the case came that same afternoon, when a traveling vacuum salesman spotted a blood-spattered purse in the middle of Tuttle Hill Road near the village of Willis, a few miles southeast of Ipsy and 9 miles from where the torched car was found. The purse belonged to one of the victims, Vivian Gold, and the working assumption was that the purse had been tossed from a moving vehicle either headed towards or away from the crime scene. Police rounded up suspects throughout the state, yet no solid leads developed. It wasn't until the following night that police had their first solid suspect. Otis Oden, a black man who ran a rooming house in Ypsilanti's colored district, turned over a .38 caliber pistol one of his boarders had left behind as a rent payment. Oden mentioned the name David Blackstone, a 26-year-old tamale vendor and ex-con on parole from Illinois State Prison in Joliet, who they called Hot Tamale. Oden said Blackstone arrived at the rooming house at 5 a.m. early Tuesday morning in a frantic state. Oden confronted him about some liquor he had allegedly stolen the night before while drinking with some friends. They shouted at each other, and then they started fighting. Either the .38 fell out of Blackstone's jacket, or he offered it to Oden as one final rent payment before he packed his things. One way or another, Odin was in possession of a .38 that, after news broke of what they were calling the Torch Murders, seemed highly suspicious. Odin must have hated Blackstone, or really wanted the reward money already offered by the Detroit News and Detroit Times, totaling $2,000, roughly $30,000 today. It was 1931, and Odin, a black man on probation, was involving himself in the brutal murder of four white teenagers, including two teenage girls. It was also more than a decade into Prohibition, and Odin ran a not-so-secret speakeasy out of his rooming house, serving whiskey and all kinds of illicit hooch. The revolver cracked the case wide open, but Odin didn't escape unscathed. His rooming house was raided by police 3 days after he turned in the revolver, police firing shots at boarders who fled in fear. Odin was arrested and charged with breaking parole and violation of Prohibition law. It's unclear if he did any time, or if he got his cut of the reward money, but Odin definitely suffered for his civic duty. Police rushed the weapon to Detroit, where ballistics tests matched the gun to bullet wounds found in the autopsies. In the early hours of Thursday morning, the results came back. This was positively the weapon used in the Torch murders. Thursday morning at 7 a.m., a little over 48 hours after the torched car was discovered, police arrested David Blackstone. They brought him into the interrogation room and tried to work a confession out of him, but the only solid leads they generated were the names of the two men he'd been with the night of the murders: Fred Curly Smith and Frank Oliver. Police knew Smith, a 22-year-old farmer from Ypsilanti who was on parole for armed robbery and car theft. Oliver was new to them, a 19-year-old from Ipsy with no previous criminal history. They arrested Smith that morning and arrived guns drawn at a house in Ypsilanti where Oliver was up a ladder painting a house. Further incriminating evidence came in from a pawn shop in Detroit where Blackstone had hawked a watch for $6, a watch that belonged to Vivian Gold. The three were brought to the jail at City Hall in Ypsilanti, where, quotation marks, due process was carried out. You might forgive police and prosecution tactics once you hear the full story of the Torch murders. Overlook the fact that the suspects were grilled in the jail until one by one they cracked. How a crowd of hundreds gathered outside City Hall once they learned the suspects were inside, one of them a black man. How they hollered at police to release the killers to the mob. How they strung nooses over trees in front of the building. Smith agreed to tell the cops everything for guaranteed protection from the mob. Blackstone said he'd prefer mob justice over life in prison. On him, they unleashed Harry Bennett and his security men. Men who had no problem beating up workers at the Ford plant who complained of long hours and bad pay. Men who fired bullets at unarmed union protesters by day and slept easy at night. David Blackstone didn't testify during his trial that night, while the men beside him admitted to everything. Blackstone didn't speak because he probably wasn't able to. Bennett and his men had ways of making him talk plenty in the interrogation room. Rumor was Blackstone's pants were pulled down. His penis laid on the interrogation table, where an unidentified interrogator smashed it repeatedly with a billy club until he told them what he did that night. And when they heard all the details, they beat him some more. This is what the killers confessed. They met at Odin's boarding house in Ypsilanti, where they drank hard liquor late into the night until they got bored. Blackstone proposed they swing by Peninsular Grove looking for young lovers spending the quiet night together and do a stick-up. Oliver drove. They saw a single car parked near the river. Oliver cut the lights. Smith and Blackstone got out, each holding a revolver. When they got to the side of the car, they told the kids inside to stick them up. Harry Lohr glanced up from inside the car with a look of recognition on his face. Smith was a neighbor of his. They used to hang out and go fishing together in more innocent times. Now Smith held Lauren at gunpoint, and the situation went very sour. Blackstone was angry, Smith paranoid. The couples were forced into the back seat of Wheatley's two-door, six-cylinder Willys sedan. They yelled for Oliver, who sat in the front seat, and held a gun on the teens. Blackstone climbed in back and sat between them, also armed. Smith took the wheel and they drove, unsure of where to go or what to do. They headed south, driving for about 30 minutes, until Smith pulled over on Tuttle Hill Road. The girls begged the bandits to let them go. "If we let you go, you'll just give us a ride to the jug," Blackstone said. They parked and the bandits got out of the car. Smith ordered the girls to join them. Anna Harrison climbed out, but Vivian Gold refused, told the men with the guns that she'd rather die. Blackstone's revolver barked in his hand 4 times. Maybe he was drunk or just had a really bad shot, but his bullets only hit one of the teens, killing Lore almost instantly. The girls were dragged from the car, where Smith and Blackstone beat their heads with rocks that they found on the ground. One of them had a wrench. Wheatley was dragged out too, his head caved in by a giant boulder, which police found after the confession, splattered with blood and brains. Blackstone dragged one of the girls into the grass and raped her. She was alive, but he likely didn't know that. Blackstone and Smith did all the damage. Oliver watched the monsters go to work. They debated what to do with the bodies, ended up throwing them in the backseat of the car, then drove the 20-plus minutes back to Peninsula Grove to get Oliver's car, the bodies piled like wood in the back seat. Bodies decompose pretty soon after death, the enzymes self-digesting, bacteria escaping the body as it literally begins to melt down. They stopped and picked up Oliver's car. Then, they just drove around, unsure what to do, maybe still drunk on hooch, shocked and covered in blood, the body still in the back seat, rigor mortis slowly setting in, Smith at the wheel, Blackstone riding shotgun, Oliver trailing them in his own car. They took River Road towards Ann Arbor, crossed to Packard, turned east towards Ypsilanti, drove past the Washtenaw Country Club. It was late, but these were very public streets. Drove down Michigan Avenue and First Street, where Blackstone got out and grabbed a shovel. They drove like this for hours. Dead bodies in the back seat. Blood drying, life snuffed out. They took US 23 past the airport, then down a deserted stretch of Washtenaw-Wayne County Road, now Rossinville Road, and they parked. Blackstone grabbed the body of the girl he hadn't assaulted at the initial crime scene, dragged her into the ditch, and raped her. She could have been dead for hours, but she wasn't. The coroner's report showed that she was alive when this happened, though Blackstone thought she was dead. When he was done, he carried the body back to the car and dumped it in the front seat. They siphoned gas from Wheatley's sedan, doused the floorboards and bodies, and lit a handkerchief, tossing it on the pile. Flames lit up the night. They piled into Oliver's car and sped back to the rooming house in Ipsy. The farmer spotted the flames right away and called the police. The trio confessed around 5 p.m. in City Hall. A trial was hastily convened for the county courthouse in Ann Arbor. The accused were whisked out the back door under the nose of a growing mob outside and driven to Ann Arbor, where a much larger crowd awaited. Their trial began at 7 p.m. Guilty pleas were entered, and the whole thing took about 30 minutes. All three guilty. Sentencing took place at 10 p.m., with the judge handing down 4 consecutive life sentences for each, the longest prison term in Michigan history. By then, the crowd grew to 12,000 people, screaming citizens raving outside the courthouse, calling for blood. The National Guard was called in to protect the building and the prisoners. They thought the coast was as clear as it was going to get at 10:30 p.m. that night. Guardsmen were ordered to fix bayonets. Tear gas was fired into the crowd, and a convoy of cars, led by Harry Bennett himself, rolled up onto the steps of the courthouse, and the guilty men were rushed out of the building. It was chaos. Shots rang out, at least one aimed at Blackstone. Several shots fired in the air from the National Guardsmen. Smith and Oliver made it to the car, and Bennett peeled off. Blackstone and his guards were swarmed, Blackstone's clothes ripped from his body. They retreated back into the building and made a hasty escape out the now uncovered back door. The cars joined up on the road, keeping watch for barricades that were rumored to have been erected by vigilantes hoping to stop the cars on their route to the prison in Jackson. At 11:33 p.m., the cars arrived in Jackson, and the men began their new lives in prison. They spent a week in solitary confinement before being shackled and stuffed into a car, which was part of an 11-officer contingent driving to the Branch Prison in Marquette, on the shores of Lake Superior. There, they would serve the longest prison sentences in the history of the state. Only one of the men would ever breathe free air again. The official cause of David Blackstone's death 19 years later was listed as a heart attack, but that's not how he went. David Blackstone was stuffed into a rock crusher by his fellow inmates and pulverized to bits in the prison yard in Marquette. Fred Smith did actually die of a heart attack in his cell in 1967 at the age of 68. Frank Oliver entered prison at age 19. When he turned 56, he was granted parole. Governor George Romney reluctantly commuted his four life sentences, and Oliver was released. He traveled to Washington State, where he worked in a nursing home, found love, and eventually married. His ultimate fate is unknown. The case scarred Ypsilanti for years. Police launched an investigation into rumors that the three killers were part of some larger gang of thugs. Robbers targeting teens headed home from dances or nights out, were parked in secluded areas like Peninsular Grove. The Grove itself lost most of its romantic value and became a site of dread and morbid curiosity. The town had an informal curfew for teenagers for many years after, fearing men like David Blackstone, Fred Smith, and clean-cut kids like Frank Oliver. The devil's in their midst. Ann Arbor Stories is presented by Rumblepack Media in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. This episode was written and read by me, Rich Reddy, with recording by Matt Dubay and sound production by Brian Peters. Thanks to everyone at the Ann Arbor District Library and their crack archive staff, who wow us each and every week by providing research on all of these tales. Please visit their work at oldnews.aadl.org. You can also follow Ann Arbor Stories on Twitter and Instagram at Ann Arbor Stories, or email your thoughts and story ideas to annarborstories@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening.